Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. And today I'll be talking with Christian Serena about his book, together with Dominique Howderovitch, Age Inclusive Public Space. And let me say a couple of words about this book before I turn directly to Christian. The book is beautiful. It's incredibly, I don't know the right word. It's beautifully typeset. It's wonderfully designed. It has a really terrific number of illustrations and photographs in it. And it's just a beautiful physical object, which I think you might expect from people that do this kind of work. But I deal with a lot of books, and this one is extraordinarily attractive. So that recommends it, and I encourage you to go out and buy it. So let me turn to Christian. Christian, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Together with my partner, Dominique, I have a small architectural office in Copenhagen, Denmark. And we started our office just one day after we graduated from the Royal Danish Academy of Fine Arts in 2013. And we have been drawing ever since then. In our studio, we are especially interested in the social potentials of architecture, I would say. And we have a particular interest in the public space. So that's how this entire subject came in our mind from the very beginning by doing.
Yes, I was going to say, sorry to interrupt. I was going to say, I would like you to talk a little bit, if you can, about the origin of the book itself and even more generally the idea that what is the right word for this? People of a certain age, as we say in English, that architects and landscape architects and designers should accommodate those people. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I can begin by saying that for us, in our work, because we are, I would like to emphasize that we are practicing architects. That means that our primary language is the drawing that the contractors make into buildings and landscapes. And very early on, it became clear for us that it doesn't really make any sense to divide this profession into a building profession and landscape profession, because we saw that the physical world was just one cohesive whole. And we saw that this division was actually leading to what I can say that that when we are in our work, day-to-day work, as missed the question. Sorry about it.
Okay. Why don't we start over? That's fine. Yeah. It's no problem at all. This happens all the time because you are answering these questions on the fly. So I certainly understand that. So let me ask the question again. Christian, I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about the origins of the book and more generally the idea of age-inclusive architecture.
Yeah, so the subject of age inclusion in our office originated from the observation that the life that we could see out of our windows, the modern metropolitan life, and especially here in Denmark and in Scandinavia, where we have this expansive welfare state, that it in many cases relies on a physical and institutional also arrangement, which is very much age graded. So different age groups, they simply live apart. And we saw that this had tremendous consequences for how for the quality of life of people. We saw we could read about these problems in the newspaper of lonely old people sitting alone. We could read about physical and mental health problems in our society. And at the same time, we could also see that right now there's a massive demographic change going on. So it basically means that we have made a society that cannot deal with the integration of age groups, but we keep on being older and older. So that was a frustrating landscape to look at from our perspective. So that's why it was actually basically our own frustration that started this topic from the very beginning.
Actually, this wasn't a question that I prepared, but you've sort of led me to ask it. It really is kind of, I don't know if it's a recent thing, but historically in the long term, it is kind of a recent thing that older people and middle-aged and younger people live apart.
Yeah.
Because that's true here in the United States as well, for the most part, and especially in urban areas, because essentially, especially retirees, they will either move to another state where there are a lot of other retirees, or they will go to a retirement home or something like that.
Yeah.
Is it the same way in Denmark?
Yeah, sure. It's the same way. And it's probably more fine-tuned here because, as I say, when we have this entire very fine meshed system of welfare care, which is a good thing, of course, in my opinion, at least. But but this also, I mean, this entire systematization relies on an age graded. The system is basically using age as a tool to divide, to give people the care that they need. It's an institutional bureaucratic tool, you can say. It eases the bureaucratic machine when it comes to providing care for people. So it's very easy for society to say that everyone aged 65 and above, they can have a flat in a nursing home and so on and so on. And this entire spatial way this has been put into reality, the way it has the spatial shaping of this idea or this system is very much much an age segregated way. So
it's very interesting because I know that in my own experiences in retirement homes, I don't think there's any thought at all to public spaces that would include younger people and people of middle age. They are, if there's any thought at all to public spaces.
Yes, definitely, because they have over prioritized the considerations towards comfort, towards having a light and warm and access to health services, and under prioritized consideration towards all the other aspects of life, which gives quality to life, the social aspects, possibilities to enter into intergenerational relationships, to experience spontaneous social encounters, and these kind of things are very much something that happens in the public space. So when you remove people from access to the public space, which is definitely the what you do when you are creating nursing homes in the way that usually have been done in modernist planning, you're actually saying refraining people from experiencing these things that make their life worth living.
I would say it's probably even worse in the United States than it's, I don't know, worse, that's a strong word, but it's probably, the problem is more severe in the United States because everybody has a house in the United States as opposed to the European pattern where people live in large buildings. Americans generally don't do that unless they live in New York or Chicago or something like that. So many times these nursing homes are miles away or kilometers away from any public space at all.
The most extreme version of the functionalist city, the American sprawl, and that has some consequences for this.
Yeah, I can imagine it does. So when you're thinking about designing an age-inclusive public space, what do you have to think about that you wouldn't ordinarily think about if you were designing a playground? And I should say, or a playground is on my mind because I have children. So I always look for a swing set. That's the most important thing for me, a swing set. But what kind of things do you think about?
When you're designing an age-inclusive public space. Yeah.
Yes, so, right.
I think the first thing before talking about what is the design, what does the design do, you have to step a little back and maybe ask yourself the question, what is it to grow old? Because that has some tremendous consequence for how you're actually designing. And a lot of spaces, also a lot of spaces designed for the elderly, for instance. This is, of course, something that is moving right now because of the demographic change. A lot of politicians, mm-hmm. a lot of architects are just trying to do something for the elderly. But what you actually need to ask yourself, in our opinion, is who are these elderly? Because it very easily becomes a stigmatizing answer. And what we are saying is that no, it's not. We want to abandon the idea that of the old person as some kind of fixed persona. They are like that, and they want this and they want that. This is the kind of thinking that we actually want to abandon, and we want to start thinking about the elderly in terms of life changing, like people who are experiencing life changes. And these changes can occur in very many different ways. And some of them are leading to a loss of function, a loss of competence, which is what is most typically what is associated with the aging process. But also we want to empathize. It can lead to a gain in knowledge, a gain in experience, a gain in competence. And what is maybe most important is when you're talking about the aging process, is that this is not something that occurs linearly. It's a complex process where things, competence vary. You get better, then you suddenly get worse, then you get better at something else. And this aging process is not something that occurs at once or doesn't affect your body and mind at the same time. So what we really want to put forward as the foundation for designing age-inclusive public spaces is a renewed sensibility towards the aging process. So when you are thinking about aging in terms of changing life conditions, you also begin to ask different questions when you're designing and when you're sitting at your drafting table or going to your planning meetings. Yeah,
I mean, you have to know your audience, obviously. And it's interesting you mentioned this because I'm 58 and I was always very athletic throughout my life. And I still am. I just do different things. So I don't go on long runs anymore, but I go on really long walks, for example. I still have to do it. I really like doing it. That kind of thing. I still consider it athletic. It's just a different kind of athleticism, I think I would call it. So I really like tracks. I like to walk around tracks. So I don't know. But I also, you know, and I have another friend who's older than I am, and in his retirement, he took up bicycling, like serious bicycling. Not. I think his bike costs more than my car.
Yeah, one of these guys. I know what you mean.
Yeah, right. And he's just like really into it, and he does these things. So, I'd be interested to know what you found in your research about the kinds of activities that elderly people gravitate toward that might be accommodated in an inclusive public space.
Yeah, so I think the most important thing, just to also keep spinning on what I said before, is that it's the public space need to be spacious enough to allow for this kind of change, to allow for one person to do different things at one day and then change his or her behavior and do something different the next day. So this is how people can be. Can experience a continuous attachment to places, even though their personal competence change, or as you say, you begin to do something differently than you did before. So a kind of environmental subtleness towards the changes in life. That's I will not say that there are certain activities that are elderly friendly, because that would again be to stigmatize the elderly, say. They like to sit and watch the children and be quiet. That's a typical age-related stigma. And this kind of ageism is actually causing a lot of harm to great many people. So I would say that it's more about creating this atmosphere where you can change within. So there are different ways of doing this, also very concrete ways of doing this. And this is,
I'm going to ask about that. Yeah, like what are the kind of steps that can be taken in order to do those things?
Yeah, one thing, and I need to just introduce a couple of concepts before I can explain.
Please,
it.
Go ahead. Please.
And that's because when you're looking at the city, we could say that some spaces are act age neutral. It doesn't matter who you are, how old you are. You can still experience these places that would be places that have some kind of atmospheric quality to them, for instance, like a usual park. It can be entered by anyone, and anyone can benefit from it. Then you have some spaces, places in the city that are age-specific, like a playground, for instance. Mm-hmm. You would instantly know that a playground is a space for children because of the colors, because of the materials used, because of the tiny scale of the playground house, and so on and so forth. So this is a space that's this kind of a reservate for children only and their parents. And these kind of age-specific spaces have become more common in the way our cities are planned to this day. We see a tendency that moves from age-neutral spaces to age-specific spaces. So we also have in our book some examples where space that's like a totally open surface where anything can happen and lots of different people are invited suddenly gets like parceled into a lot of different age-specific spaces, a playground for the small toddlers and a cage for playing ball for the youngsters and some benches for the elderly and so on. So this is, it becomes very stiff, the city, and it becomes very regulated who is to enter where. And this regulation relies on age categories. So what we are saying is that one way to deal with this, one way to break this up and try to integrate different age groups is to organize it, these age-specific elements, like the swing you talked about in the beginning of the slide, to organize it in a way that brings it into a relationship with some elements that speak to different ages, right? You can also try to work with the spatial boundaries to make one space kind of integrate or slide into the other one and create this like soft spatial maneuvers that makes the playground kind of morph into the rest of the park, for instance. That would give an expression of an age-inclusive environment, even though the elements within that environment still caters to specific age groups. But what we also want to say that there's a different way. Yeah, sorry.
I was going to say about the swing set and such, and I mentioned that because in the parks where I live in a sort of small town in Western Massachusetts. The stuff that's for kids is all segregated. It's all in one place. Yeah. It's in one corner of the park. Like that's where the parents go with their kids. The other parts of the park are entirely for different purposes. So they didn't give any consideration to including, there are no benches by the swing set. So you stand there and watch your kids. So I know just exactly what you're talking about, having done this many times in my life. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, that's a perfect example of an age-specific space, and that's what we see everywhere in every city in the world around the world. This kind of planning, because I guess it's very easy, and it's like a board game where you can place a space to the children and one to the little older, and so on and so forth. But what we want to say is that there are also ways of designing that completely disregards that or refuses that some spaces speak to certain age groups. And these are one way is to draw something or to design something in a polyvalent way, we call it. And polyvalence is about when we enter a space, or we instantly look for ways to make use of the environment, of the geometries that we are seeing, right? So this is also something that children are especially good at. So we are looking for clues in our environment that if we want to sit, we are looking for places where we can sit. But usually we're just presented with a chair, and that is a generic object that we know, okay, we can go and sit on that. But we can use this ability of the human race to read form for use in a different way, and we can do it so we can make form polyvalent. That means that it is not functional specific. It is open for interpretation. That means that there are all kinds of different people will read this form, each one of them differently. So that means that one single space, if it is made in a polyvalent way, can permit different interpretations. So one, the child will read it as a public playground, maybe, and run about and jump off its sides. Another one will read it as a sculpture landmark, maybe, or a place to sit, or a place to rest, or a place to play, or whatever. So this is a way of kind of giving a little loose, making the city more open to different interpretations, instead of just trying to, when you're designing, trying to fix everything into a very narrow functional recipe, right?
I have an interesting example of that in a local park. And it's kind of puzzling what they did. It is downtown in my small town, and I would call it a kind of overgrown rock garden.
Yeah.
These are enormous, smooth boulders.
Yeah.
And you're not quite sure what you're supposed to do with it. Like, I go there and I sit on the boulders or I walk around them. My kids just climb all over them. But it's not entirely clear what they're there for. And if someone were an artist, they might say, oh, that's a rock garden.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a perfect example of polyvalent landscape, yeah.
Yeah. Also, another thing is we have a skate park near us, which is quite segregated from everything else, but I do take my kids there. But there are different sorts of levels and things there that I kind of like to crawl around and walk on. Now, the kids are skating, but I'm crawling around and walking on them. I mean, it's clearly a skate park. But for me, it's an entirely different thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It speaks to this very primitive nature of man, that if something is high, you want to climb it. And if something is long, you want to walk on it. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, one thing I've also noticed in another park that I used to take my kids to is there was a pool. It was a shallow pool, and it was kind of a wading pool. At least that's the way I thought of it. My kids thought it was a swimming pool because they would just, you know, it's only about 2 feet deep, so no one was going to drown. But it wasn't quite clear what it was for. But it was very cool. I remember that very well. And yeah, it was a very open design in a sense, as you didn't really know what you were supposed to use it for, but it was there.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah. And things can also be... because when you're this concept of polyvalence is still about how to use form or to use spaces, but you could also work with space in a way that refuses this functional emphasis. You can. This is why we bring out the atmosphere as a concept in the book, because this is something that. Maybe it's still there in the cities, but it has been a little under-prioritized, I would say, because atmosphere is this sensoric experience that you can have. This can come from trees or flowers or water, as you mentioned. But it's something that every age, every person, no matter capacity or background or socioeconomic status or whatever, can still experience. it's something that is an experience. That's a common thing in the public space. So I think there's a great many opportunities in this.
Yeah, area. just to give another example of another park that I've been to with my kids, which I think is at least evocative or seems to be kind of what you're saying about, is that there was a kind of pyramid of blocks that went up probably 10 feet and they were arranged. I mean, again, it looked like something out of ancient Egypt, kind of, but it wasn't that tall. But for me, it was interesting because I could climb up, but it wasn't too much. Now my kids were just all over it. Like you couldn't believe it. And these blocks were strewn not only in this pyramid, but all over the place. There were no benches in the park. So clearly the designers were telling us to climb on them or sit on them or warm ourselves on them or something, but it wasn't clear. Like a park bench is like you're supposed to sit on the park bench, right?
Yeah,
that's exactly. That's what you do on a park bench. But these weren't like that at all. They were much more inclusive in that sense that they invited you to kind of experiment with them and things that you might do.
Yeah, and the great thing is that the seating opportunity persists. And what it does is if you just had some park benches, you could sit on those benches, but what would you look at? What kind of life would be there? Probably a very dull life without anything happening. But right in when you have these pyramids, you have children climbing all over them. So at your bench is also a theater to look at with a lot of activity going on.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Why would you need a bench if there's nothing to be there for?
That's quite true. Yeah. Usually there isn't anything to do. And often, at least in the United States, the park benches are boundaries and they kind of keep you out of the park. Now, of course, in the United States, there are actual fences, which I don't think you would probably think are a good idea, but there are chain link fences around some of these things. I'd like to talk a little bit about materials, and you mentioned water. Another one to draw from my own personal experiences. Oftentimes, these parks, the older ones, will have sandboxes. Do you know what I mean by a sandbox? Yeah, right. But they'll be very small. I've always wanted to go to a park that had a sandbox that was about 30 meters by 30 meters.
like a true landscape.
Right, that would be fun. Can you talk a little bit about the materials and that kind of element that you put into these things?
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about atmospheric experiences, of course, there's a great difference in making a sandbox as this kind of very tiny little
container for kids,
and then making something that has an atmospheric value for anyone who visits this space. And actually, there has been some like truly radical expressions of playscapes early on in the history of the playground, and some of them are actually not only for kids; they are made for all ages. Also some American actually, and these are some of the rare examples of like grand scale, polyvalent atmospheric landscapes that are truly age inclusive. So this age inclusive agenda has actually been experimented with from the children's perspective more than from the elderly's perspective, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, no, I see just what you mean. Another element that I've seen in some, I'm going to talk about water in a second, but another thing that I've seen, and this is very old, are topiary mazes. Do you know what I mean by that? These are mazes made of shrubs.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, those are very old, and I've only been to a couple parks that have them, but they seem very inclusive to me.
Yeah, I mean, they can be experienced in a great many different ways. At a distance also, they are different than when you are entering them.
Well, I was going to say one thing. I think they're a lot more fun for kids because they tend to be about 3 feet high. I'm very tall, so they're not quite as much fun for me. But that's probably a consideration. And then I suspect also that if you're going to use trees and shrubs for this kind of thing, there's an expense issue, unlike rocks or water, correct?
Oh, that depends where you are in the world. Here it would be, probably.
I mean, I know that here they have to be tended and things like this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that they do here, and which I quite like, if you go to a kind of English garden, which we have some of, mm-hmm. these are just trees and a kind of greensward, is when the trees lose their leaves, they leave the leaves.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can play in them, which I still like to do, even though I'm old.
another example. An example we also have in the book is when it snows. This is a rare opportunity in the city because all these... Yeah. Borders you have between sidewalks and parking lots and car lanes, they suddenly diminish, and what you see is just one cohesive landscape of white snow, which can also be experienced from a great many different angles. So children would throw snowballs and run around, where other people will just experience this also social phenomenon of being in the snow together. So this is a great example also, like the leaves. And actually, the English gardens are kind of polyvalent playful landscapes, I would say. Right?
Yeah, they're lovely. They're lovely. And we have a great one here in Northampton where I live, which is very well tended private. And it's very beautiful. And it has a little rivulet in it, a little stream, and it has a pond, and it's very open. There are no borders, and the trees are lovely. They're lovely deciduous trees, and it's very well tended. And as I say, they put sometimes they leave the leaves on the ground, and then they'll put them in big piles. So you can play with them in the pile. But I'll tell you, here's an interesting thing, and you might want to include this in your next edition. I don't know if it's in this one, but I'll tell you something accidental that happened here is that there was a large parking lot that adjoined a playground. And it wasn't exactly a playground. It's more of a park, a small park. And they sent the snow clearing machines to remove the snow from the parking lot. And it created a snow mountain.
Yeah.
And this thing drew everybody. Everybody wanted to climb on the snow mountain. Kids were up there digging holes in it and throwing snowballs. And I was climbing on it. And it was just a really fun feature that just appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example. We actually, in our office, convinced the guys who run these snow plows to strategically place their snow piles in the city so that these kind of situations could occur.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And it was really wonderful. And then the next year they said that they couldn't do it anymore because of liability issues.
Oh, yeah. That's a classic.
Yeah, it is. And also on the same thing, at least they used to do this out here. I don't know if they do it in Denmark, but something that used to happen that doesn't happen anymore is that they would take a park and they would make they would put a ring around part of it and flood it, and it would become an ice skating rink.
Yeah, they do that. That's also
do that in Denmark?
Yeah, they do. Yeah. And in the summertime, they can splash around in the water.
Yeah, here they can't do it anymore, again, for liability issues. They used to be small skating rinks, sort of pop-up skating rinks all over the place, but they can't do it anymore. Yeah. It is a pity, actually. Can you talk a little bit about the role of water in these things and how water can be used?
I mean, water is a landscape feature that can be experienced in great many different ways. It is actually polyvalent, right? You can mm-hmm. use it in many different ways, as a play tool, but it's also an atmospheric experience you can have. So it has all of these qualities that we are talking about in the book.
Yeah. Again, one of the things I've seen before is, and this is actually at an amusement park, is they have they're essentially cylinders that you walk up to in the summer, and they spray a big cloud of mist at you. and you don't really quite know what to do with that, but it's sort of fun. You know what I mean? Those are extraordinarily entertaining.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, this is something that we are also using this misty mist installations in the book as examples of how the value of this social setting that the public space can offer, that the being together, even though we are a great many different people. So
yeah. Another one, I hate to give so many examples, but your book got me thinking about some really well-designed ones. One that is in our community too. It's at a public park, and it's what's called a water park, I think. And essentially it's a large piece of concrete. It's circular.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big flat area. And there are these pylons that stick up out of it, and they sort of randomly spray water in different ways and at different intervals. So it's kind of a game to see which ones are going to go off when.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking at all?
Yeah, sure.
It's really in Germany,
I think.
And I can tell you that people of all ages go to this thing when it's really hot, right? And the kids can't drown because there's not enough water. I mean, it's a big piece of concrete, and it's just a lot of fun. And it is surrounded by benches as well. And it's a very popular thing around here because when it's 100 degrees here, Fahrenheit, you really need to get cool. And so you can go to the water park and just hang out there. It's a lot of fun and much safer than a swimming pool.
Yeah, so this is an example of a place that maybe all people cannot access or participate in directly, but if there's offered some distant opportunities to engage in a more passive way or from a distance, this can also prove intergenerational have some value as an intergenerational scene.
I can tell you that with this water park in particular, you can't. It's very hard to stand and watch people play in the water when it's hot.
Yeah.
Because you inevitably end up in the water.
Yeah, right? It's true.
At least it's true of me. I don't know how many times I've gone there with that. I wanted to talk a little bit about games, because I know that having been in Europe a bunch of times, and just particularly to in Italy, I think there are various lawn games, I think I would call them, that are sprinkled. You know what I'm talking about? Lawn bowling, I think it is.
Yeah, the different kinds of games. Yeah.
So do you sprinkle games in your designs? Or games, do they feature in your designs?
Yeah, they can. I mean, I cannot quite remember with, but of course we are always, because we want to when we are drawing a project in our studio, we also always want to think about how is there any playful opportunities here? How would the adults or children alike use this as a starting point for play? So, and long games could easily be one way of doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me a kind of natural thing, especially lawn bowling, because it's pretty, it's inexpensive and doesn't take a lot of maintenance, and it's pretty easy to do. So that would be, we don't have anything like that here, but I would really enjoy that kind of thing if it were available, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
And let me ask about this. It is age inclusive, and I don't want to stereotype elderly people, but oftentimes their movement is inhibited. They might be on crutches or in wheelchairs or something like that. What sort of steps do you take to accommodate those kinds of things in your designs?
Yeah, of course, that's a part of the aging process. That's some of these changes I talked about early on. That is, of course, that's basically what happens when you have used your legs for a long time. They start to hurt at one point, and then you cannot walk as well. So this is some considerations that definitely should be prioritized in any project. That of course people should also in wheelchairs or with crutches should be able to access spaces, but. What is important when you're talking about age inclusion is that this access must not be some kind of a special route. Or, so, you know, there's a, oftentimes you see a wheelchair ramp hidden in the back in the rear side of a building or something. So just walk in there and turn around, and you can go up your handicap ramp. And that's not really an age inclusive approach. So what we are talking about here is that how to integrate it in the design so that it's a natural part of the physical environment is that, of course, any people, no matter how they move, should be able to access places.
Yeah, that's right. And here, at least in some parks I've been in the United States, they've done a terrific job of this by essentially replacing steep stairs with ramps of various sorts. But they're not, as you say, they are not for wheelchairs or anything. They're for everybody to go up and down.
Yeah.
They're not marked as, you know, if you have a wheelchair, go up this. They are for everyone. So essentially, and you get that nice aesthetic curvature as well. You know, they're aesthetically pleasing because
there are many opportunities. Kind of
they're really very nice. So we've taken up a lot of your time. There are a couple more questions I have, though, just to keep you for another second. If an urban planner or somebody was interested in talking to someone like you, is there a website they could go to, or is there a federation of people that do this, or how do you start? Just contact your local architect, or is there who would somebody contact if they were interested in creating an age inclusive space for their community?
Yeah, they could.
They should contact you, of course. But.
Of course, but there are also other architects, of course, one of the reasons this book we have done here, it has a lot of contributions from a great number of researchers from various disciplines. And what we have done is we have tried to make their contributions very dense, but also to give space for them to point the reader towards other books or other practitioners. So I guess the book could be one way of getting an overview of who.
There you go. Buy the book. That's how you do it. Buy the book. Yeah, that's great.
Or start out by going to our webpage. You can do that. And that is also a start. It's studio.ds.dk.
Yeah, we'll certainly put it. We'll put a link to it on the blog write-up that will accompany the interview so everybody can go. We'll put a link to the book as well.
But frankly, this is something new for spatial practitioners. This is not something that has been like the primary focus of a great many number of architects. Many people have done this has tried to make the physical environment more accessible. That's the only like aspect of the entire subject that has been thoroughly implemented in many countries. Like you said, you know about these ramps and stuff. So this is like one step of the task. But the other steps have not really been taken yet, and these are about.
I think, sorry to interrupt, I think that's a very important distinction and one that really wasn't in my mind before I saw the book. And that is the difference between accessibility and inclusiveness. They're different. They're really quite different. So you should be able to produce a design that is both.
Of course, accessibility is part of an inclusive environment. But you cannot only have accessibility because... What does it mean to access a space if it doesn't mean anything to you, for instance? If it's not a part of your everyday routines, if it's not a place that you have a special attachment to or somewhere where you feel you belong. Of course, the spaces that are part of our lives should have some kind of a meaning for us. And these aspects of belonging to places of the public space are very important and doesn't really... Are not contained within the concept of accessibility.
That's very well said, Christian. Very well said. So let me tell everybody that we've been talking to Christian Serena about his book, Age Inclusive Public Space. It's available now. Christian, let me ask our traditional final question on new books in the New Books Network. What are you working on now? Do you have a next project?
Yeah, I mean, as because I'm a practicing architect, so I have so what we're trying to do is to further experiment with these spatial concepts and try to implement them in reality to build them and see what happens and learn from that.
That's a lot, and I hope you get to do that. So let me say to everyone, well, first let me say to Christiane, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, and let me say to all the listeners, thank you for listening to the New Books Network, and I will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.